Hello and welcome to our AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology webinar. And thank you all so much for participating today. My name is Kara Hansel-Keehan and I'm the executive editor of AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology. And joining me also is my colleague Michelle Gaffney, our editorial consultant. I'd like to let you all know that we are recording today's webinar to post later on the AJP Heart and Circ website. But now I'll get started by introducing to you our panel of distinguished speakers. First, you will hear from Dr. William C. Stanley, Editor-in-Chief of AJP Heart and Circ. Our second speaker will be Dr. David A. Cass, Senior Associate Editor at AJP Heart and Circ. And our third and final speaker will be Dr. Nancy L. Kanegi, Associate Editor of AJP Heart and Circ. So let's get started. Bill?
Thanks, Kara. I want to welcome you all. We have people from all around the world, and we're going to have, a very interesting discussion. We have the next slide there, Kara?
Yes.
Our journal receives a lot of papers, and we have to get a lot of reviewers. We get about 1,000 manuscripts a year, and with the initial review, we have 3 reviewers on each manuscript, and then we have resubmissions. So we need 4,000 or 5,000 reviews done every year. And we really rely on expert reviewers, and it can be a bit difficult. Now, the way it works is the manuscripts come in, they get screened, and then I assign them to an associate editor. We do reject some because they're inappropriate or very low quality, but assign most of them, 90%, 95%, to an associate or consulting editor. Now, that editor is the one who determines who to invite. And I think most of you attending here want to become reviewers, and that's the control point. Our associate and consulting editors will initially invite 3, but usually 7 to 10 potential reviewers. Most people who are invited don't want to review, so it usually takes to get 3 reviewers will take 6 or 8, 10 invitations. The first 3 people to accept the invitation get the paper. We do it on a first come, first served basis, so we have that automated, so whoever gets it, except the first gets it. The paper then is out for review. We allow 14 days, and this is an important point. You got to get your review in on time, and we get the critiques in, and the associate editor then makes the decision of whether to reject the paper or send it out back to the authors for revision. Now, one thing that we do, and I think most journals are doing this now, is when the reviews come in and the decision's being made, the associate editor will rank the reviewers. And we have a simple system, excellent, good, fair, poor. And that sits tagged to the reviewer. So when they come up in the system, we look and can see, oh, that's a poor reviewer or just a fair reviewer. There's some problem. That ranking is usually based on performance. You know, was it a good review? Was it on time? Was there a problem? So that's another control point. Who gets invited to review, and how do you become a reviewer? Well, potential reviewers are recommended by the authors. This is really a critical point. We really pay attention to that. If author recommends someone to review their paper and they're clearly an expert, we'll invite them. We really respect that. We will look to make sure, actually the system will check to make sure that they're not the same institution or that they haven't published together. But we will respect that, and we will usually invite 1 or 2 of the recommended reviewers. So if you're recommended by authors, that is one way to become a reviewer. Generally, though, it's the experts in the field. So we look for recognized experts in the field. Often those are people who are referenced in the paper. These are players in that particular area. And then last and very importantly, we go to our editorial board. We have a big editorial board, about 160 people. And they're diverse, they're specialized, and so we cover all areas. And they provide about a third of our reviews. So we really work them hard. So if you can get on an editorial board, that's great. Generally, though, the people on the editorial board are either very senior or they're younger, more junior, well-funded experts in the field. So it's not easy to get on the editorial board. But one way that we get reviewers, particularly on papers that are difficult to get help on, is we go to those who were recommended by the initial invitees who decline. So in our system, when someone declines to review, they're asked to recommend potential reviewers. We look at those pretty carefully. So if we've sent out our first invitation to get our three reviewers, we invited, say, eight people, and six declined. We got two reviewers. We'll look at who's been recommended. And often, if we get two very good reviewers, we still need a third. And a senior person who's declined, who we respect, says, hey, I got this junior guy down the hall, or I got this person over here who's really good. You should try them. We'll try to invite in a younger, less experienced person, a new person, an early career investigator, and let them review. So that's one way to get into the system. Next slide, Kara. So how do you get reviewer invitations? Well, the number one way is to have a high prominence in your specific area of cardiovascular research so that authors recommend you as a potential reviewer, and also so that the associate editors know who you are. So that's the number one way, and that's the kind of the front door way of getting invitations. The other way is to have current reviewers or editorial board members recommend you when they decline their invitation to review. So this could be your former postdoc mentor, a collaborator, someone in your academic unit, your department, or your institution. Just talk to them. Say, hey, I'm looking to review, and if you have anything that you can't handle in my area of expertise, please consider recommending me. I think it's good to be that straightforward with it. You really just need to network on this and express to your colleagues your willingness and your expertise in reviewing. The other way that we look at it, and the editors are very aware of who's been submitting and publishing in our journal. And if you submit your senior author papers to a journal, that goes a long way, and it helps a lot. We'll even get occasionally email from an author saying, hey, I just published in your journal. I'd love to review. If you have anything, keep me in mind. And we will. So that's helpful. Most importantly, number four, when you do review, you've got to do a really good job. You've got to deliver a good critiques and good comments to the editors. It's a key thing. You've got to be on time, be thorough, be polite, be constructive, all the things you're going to hear about from David and Ann. And you want to maintain in the system a high reviewer rating so you aren't marked as a bad reviewer, so it's really critical to deliver a good product. Next slide. So with that, do you have any questions?
Right, so we have time for a few questions on this section, and if you do have questions, if you could please click on the raise hand icon on the left side of your GoToWebinar control panel. So it looks like we have a question. Yes, Emily Cox, go ahead.
How do we know our ratings in the AJP Journal rating system? I know the last point.
Yeah, Yeah, the question, how do you know your rating in the system? And I think most journals do this kind of thing, and you don't. You can't see it, and we wouldn't give that out. Yeah, but it's helpful for us because often, you know, I'll go to a big leader in a particular field, and I think, oh, they'll be a great reviewer, and they'll have a terrible rating. And I can look up, and maybe they're taking 32 days to review a paper, and then I'm not going to use them. But we don't let that information out. Yeah, it's kind of like asking for a letter of recommendation and wanting to read it first. We don't let you do that. but we do keep it, and it's private. And I think most journals do this exactly like we do. They don't let it out.
Okay, Rukmani, go ahead with your question.
Hi, I just typed it. I was wondering if in one of the reviews one person make and they get a bad score. Is there any possibility that the person will be asked again to review?
Yeah, so basically that's what, how do you get invited back when you review? And the main thing is to deliver on-time, high-quality reviews, which you'll hear about how to do that in a second. It's really that simple. If you can really turn them around in 7 days, that's really helpful, 10 days, not on day 14. If you're getting reminders, that's a bad thing. The way I do it personally, especially when I was more junior, if I got invited to review for AJP or one of the journals I really respected, I would turn it around in a day or two, and I would do a really good job. I would complete the review, let it sit, read it, proofread it, and then send it in. And I think that's how I got invited to get on editorial boards and things like that, despite good performance. It's just that simple.
So we have a question from Rashmi. Go ahead, Rashmi.
Hi.
Hi, Dr. Stanley. How are you?
Good.
Oftentimes, a faculty or my mentor or my advisor, when they receive an article to review, they pass it on to junior, postdoc, or grad student to take a look and also get trained on trying to learn how to review a paper.
Yes.
So is there a provision to include that assistance and by that way get introduced as a potential reviewer?
That's a really good question. So what we do is we often get reviews back from established people, maybe on the editorial board, and they'll make the comment, so-and-so in my lab assisted me with this review. And we don't keep a record of that, but I think that's a good mentor that does that. And what I do personally when I mentor is I will do that with the senior grad student or junior postdoc. But then at some point, I'll get invited and I'll just say, hey, ask this person to be the primary reviewer. And then I'll hand it over, try to get them their independent invitation. So it really is a great way for you to learn how to review, and that's a sign of a good mentor. But at some point, they should be when they turn down reviews, they should recommend you as the reviewer. And they can write that. When you turn down a review, they can say, look, I've got this senior postdoc who's really good. I encourage you to invite them directly. And I will do that if I already have two really more established reviewers on the paper. I'll bring in that postdoc, especially if it's recommended by someone I really respect and trust. Does that answer your question there?
So there is a written question from Bernard, and his question is, what feedback does the reviewer get for his or her job that they've done?
Yeah, what feedback do reviewers get? You get a copy of the decision letter. It's available online. I think it's emailed to everybody. And then all the critiques. So you get to see what's been done. We don't say, good job, here's your rating, whatever. We don't do that. But you can see how you've done relative to the decision. So I'm really anxious when I review papers to see how my review fits in with the other reviews and the opinion of the editor. And so most people really want to see that. And most of the time I'm right in there. Sometimes I'm way out. I'm too harsh or too easy or something. But that's really your point of feedback, when you can see the decision letter and what the other two or three reviewers said about the paper.
Okay, so we have time for two or three last questions. I'm going to read them since they were typed
Great.
In.
Yeah.
One is from
Great.
Paul, and he would like to know, what are the key points you look for in a high-quality review?
I'm going to just put that to the side and let Dave and Ann, because they'll be addressing that in great detail. But yeah.
Great. Another question is, does the AE know the reviewer, or is that blinded as well?
Yeah, so the AEs definitely know the reviewers. It's not blinded at all. It's blinded in the system so that we can all see it. I can see it, and the staff can see it. And the
single blinded.
AE can see it, but other AEs can't see other people's papers. We do restrict that. So it's, I think, the only way you can do it. The AE really needs to know who's saying what.
We have time for this last question.
Well, maybe let me just address that really quick. So
sure.
When the AE makes a decision, you know, you may have two reviewers who really love the paper and one who hates it. And then you kind of need to know, because there's some personality. Maybe the paper, the data isn't challenges that particular reviewer. And so the decision's made, really needs to be made in context. So they do need to know who's saying what, who the person is.
Yeah. Okay, great. So the last question comes from Jin, and it is this. Does it count against a reviewer point-wise for future assignments if one declines a review? Sometimes scheduling gets really tight, and sometimes the manuscript isn't within my expertise.
Yep, so it does, yes. And we have some editorial board members who just start declining, you know, half the invitations, and we just take them off the editorial board. We don't want reviewers that are difficult to get. So now, that said, if you're writing, have a grant deadline, or you're teaching a lot, we really do appreciate it when you say, I'm sorry, you know, I can't take it this time, but because of a grant deadline, but please think of me in the future. And then that's not a problem. But the chronic, frequent declining of invitations is death. we're not going to keep inviting you if you're declining more than half the invitations from that level. So we really don't want people to decline routinely.
Okay, great. So I'm going to say anyone whose question didn't get answered, you can either pose it a little bit later on. And so we'll move on. Thank you so much, Bill. We're going to move on to Dr. David Cass. Okay, David, go ahead.
Hi. So thanks, Sarah. And indeed, I'll follow up on this issue. It's a sort of a personal approach, bit up front, of how to approach reviewing a paper. Certainly, this is from the perspective not only as someone who's submitted papers and gets reviews back, but as someone who's been on an editorial board for a long time and looks at various reviews and tries to decide, you know, what's a good review and not a good review. And I talk about the Gestalt, you know, this German word for sort of overall impression, and what I would describe as kind of a microscope approach, where you start on very low power and you're really looking broadly, and then you cone down more and more. So, you know, for me, the most important thing initially to ask is, this an interesting question that's being studied? Is this novel? Is this something that, you know, we're going to be excited about? And then, you know, if the answer to that is yes, and each of these are like filters, high-level filters, does it then look like the investigators have an appropriate approach to really answering this question? Is the methodology look like it's going to be appropriate? What do they actually do? And then, again, if it's sort of past that filter, then the next issue is really, are the results surprising or interesting? Is this in particular going to be exciting? Is it incremental, or is it going to be exciting and potentially the field in the direction that, you know, we weren't thinking? If you can pass all of these and you even have cool methodology involved, then, you know, you put this in certainly a good box to start with. And if you don't pass those filters, I think it depends upon I guess how clear you decided in looking over the abstract, and as I'll talk about tactics, kind of looking over, still somewhat superficial, but the key data, just the data, then you may already have approached the paper somewhat differently. You can be changed. You can go into higher power, start looking at it in more detail, and change your mind. But for me, I really like to get this general sense of how this is going to play out. And I do it mostly from the abstract and the figures. So I go over the abstract, and it's generally clear, just like we talk about, people write your specific aims page for a grant, and whether your grant rises and falls often depends upon how well you can present what it is you're doing, why you're doing it, how important it is. Well, the abstract gets that across, and so I think it certainly is an opportunity as the reviewer to get an idea of where this is going, and how many of those initial filters has it passed. As I said, then the other thing I do is generally go right to the figures and figure legends and sort of walk through, without reading the paper really fully yet, you get a quick sense of what kind of study this is, what sort of the level of detail that's been presented. Does this look like it's a mechanistic approach? Is it largely a descriptive approach? You can generally quickly get a sense of the quality of the data that's getting presented, again, the sort of the level of detail. The logical progression of the way the data are presented, and what sort of paper is that you're going to be dealing with. We're still low power microscope. If basically I've sort of come to the conclusion that this has got a solid feel to it, that this looks interesting, this is going to be an interesting story, then I bring out the higher power lenses, and you start getting into the nitty gritty of really what's been done, and ultimately, for a really good review, you're going to be not just focusing on minute details, but critical things that you see in the data or in the interpretation of the data or the presentation of the data that either leave things a little more ambiguous than would be ideal or incomplete or simply inconclusive. So in continuing with tactics, at this point, I read it. And I sort of read it straight now. This is really, I've now been gone through the abstract, I've looked at the figures, I sort of know where this is going, and now I'm just going to read it as if it was being published. And I don't stop until I've got to the end, and I'm still sort of now assessing, was my initial gestalt sort of right? Do I think this is something that's we should publish? Is this something that should be rejected? There's no way, I can't imagine how we can fix this. I'm going to spend, I suppose, a different amount of time in terms of getting into the nitty-gritty, depending upon the answer to this question. That's my own personal perspective. If I think a paper is going to get, it really didn't hit the mark, and I'm going to recommend a rejection, and I've already satisfied myself by going through all the figures, going through all the data tables, everything, plus just reading it over, that it's not going to be there. I'm personally not going to spend a lot of time going into all the details. I will make it clear, generally, in broader swipes that these are the reasons I thought the paper was what it was. But clearly, if I think it's going to be something that's going to get revised and ultimately accepted, then you have to get into these details. And I do this very systematically, going through each of the sections of the results, going back to the figures and tables, and in each case asking, what was the question that was raised by this particular set of data? Do the data support it? Does this conclusion that is being made make sense? What's missing? Are there problems? Do I see a methodologic problem? Does it fit together? And most papers are stories, and these stories follow sequentially in a logical manner. As the components of the story are laid out, and you get to identify it at each point. One piece of advice that I would say for reviewers, as well as, frankly, reviewers of papers, as well as reviewers of grants, is that your job is to identify, I think, important problems and make suggestions and try to identify if the paper is going to be something that you believe HAP should be considering for publication. Try to provide insight, your insight back to the author that would improve it, and or make sure that issues that ideally should have been dealt with before it gets published. This does not mean that every single, you know, a comma or a semicolon or, and some reviewers do this, but I don't think you need to be overly picky. I think you need to get the broader, more important details that are there that should be approached. And this is what makes a good review, actually, in the end. And then one thing that I would strongly suggest to people is that you read the paper and you approach the paper as it's been done by the folks who did the research. This is not something that you're trying to morph into a different story, a different paper, regardless of what your thoughts may be. I think if it really has to be a completely different paper, and that's the only way you can ever imagine it being accepted, then reject it. I mean, as an editor, we would appreciate hearing from reviewers to say, you know, no, not this story. It would have to be a different story. And that your job in that sense, once you've gone beyond the point where you've decided, okay, I think this is something that we should publish. This is a paper that's going to be of interest to the readers, but here are the issues. Then you're really working with what was done, and you're trying to enhance it through your suggestions and critiques and point out things that the authors may not all agree with. We've all been there. But, this is fuel for discussion and hopefully paper improvement, but not trying to make it something it isn't. I really think that's a mistake that some people fall into, and I don't believe it's helpful for the authors, and in the end, it's not really helpful for the editors either when you do that. And then I think my last set of comments is just sort of from the standpoint of an editor, what makes a good review for us? When, you know, what you're interested in how you get rated and what, you know, what are we looking for? So when you respond to us, this brief section, you know, to the editors, you should remember that we didn't probably read the paper. We're looking at this, we read the abstract. As an editor, before I assign it, I look at it briefly. I look at all the figures. I do kind of what I talked about at the beginning with my gestalt. I sort of get a sense of who I think, you know, I have to do this to figure out who I would send it to. But I certainly did not read it in anywhere near the detail that you did. And you need to make sure that your comments to us are concise, pointed, direct, and clear, and get across a couple of critical issues. Just what I started with. Is this novel? Is it exciting? Is it going to be incremental? Is it frankly boring? Is it going to be useful? I mean, this is what we want to hear within the first couple of sentences. And then why? And again, sort of short, very much direct. Tell us, you know, why you think this is what, you know, this is what you believe. This is why you liked it. This is why you didn't like it. If any of you ever done grant review, it's the same thing. You get your first couple of minutes to explain to a committee in real time why you like it, why you don't like it, what was important. Please don't cut and paste your review to the authors. That's going to be much more detail in this section that's going to the editors. We don't like it. It doesn't help us. We've lost the gestalt. We have to weed through your language, which may be more polite, often is, to the authors than it would be necessarily directed to the editors. You want the editors to know what you really think. You want the authors to know what you think, but you may not use exactly those words. So I think it's very important that you really cut to the chase when you're telling the editors where you stand on the review. And then lastly, and this happens, don't tell us one thing, which can often be, I really didn't like this at all. And then you provide comments to the authors which really are sending the opposite message. It works either way, but often it's more that the editors are told that you're not very enthusiastic, you know, you're almost ready to suggest a rejection for, you know, whatever reason. And then in the comments to the authors, it all sounds very straightforward, you know, if you do this and this and this. That makes it tough for us, for sure, to synthesize. And one way or another, we have to come up with a message that we're going to send to the authors that's cohesive. But in the deep down inside, we know you really didn't like it. Or you really like it, and then you proceed to you know, basically trash it, your comments to the authors. That doesn't work either. So you want these things to be consistent. What you tell the editors has got its value and its point that needs to be concise and very direct and targeted. And what you tell the authors is more detailed. But nonetheless, they have to be in concert and with balance. So I think that's a 30,000 honed down to, I don't know, 500 foot view of how I approach at least reviewing papers and giving what I think are good reviews back to the editors. Questions?
So we do have one right away, and that is this. In some cases, this is from Junie Warrington, in some cases the science is great, but the English is so bad that it is distracting. How would you deal with a situation like this? Do you still judge only on the science?
Yes. So I in a way, that's why I said at the beginning, I focus on the figures, the data. I mean, I say figures, if they're tables, but I look at the data, and when you go through the data without necessarily reading the text, just looking at what's been presented, this was a PowerPoint presentation, and you couldn't hear the person, you can just see it, and you can see the words that describe the figures, you usually can tell, you know, what the level of the science is. I don't need their language. But even when I get to the point where I'm going back and I'm reading the paper, if it's totally confusing, and I can't figure out anything, even if I have a hint that the science might be great, that's a problem. That's rare. I think what's much more common is just not terribly good grammar, not a native English speaker, or there are issues related to the writing that I can identify, but it's fairly easy to tell that the science is crackerjack, you know, it's spot on, it's interesting. This should be done, in which case, personally, I do not become an English language editor. I've been doing this long enough, and I may have started off doing a bit more of that. I don't do that anymore. But I will make it very clear in a comment that, you know, the manuscript was confusing, difficult to read, really needs an English language editor to take a serious crack at it, or, in fact, will not be suitable for publication. And that may be a comment I would give to the editor, in addition to a just slightly different worded version for the authors. And then, as an editor, when I send letters out to the authors, I will make that point. You know, we're interested. You got to get the language fixed up.
So we have a couple more questions for you, David. If the paper fails the initial screen, going through the abstract and figures, for example, do you stop there?
No, I mean, I do read it. I do sit down and read it, but I will agree that how I then read it, it's a little bit more like prove me wrong. I mean, this may not be fair, but the paper has the opportunity, I am going to read it from start to finish, of actually ending up proving that my initial impression was wrong. And that's not so common, because you get, you know, generally, the more you do this, and the more the better you get at this sort of gestalt evaluation, the rarer it is that you just completely missed it. But it happens, and every paper gets a completely fair shot. But it would be very, very rare for me to have concluded that there's nothing here that I really can see is suitable for AJP. And then it's only when I'm spending, a lot of time going down into nitty-gritty that I suddenly discovered I was wrong. But I don't stop. I don't just stop. But it does change my approach. I'm then reading it kind of looking for evidence that I was wrong, my impression's wrong. And there really is something much more here than I realized. And, we start again.
All right. So I think this is a really important question, given your emphasis on clear comments to the editors. Do you always have to include comments to the editor, or will comments to the author suffice, especially if the comments to the editor would simply echo the comments to the authors?
So the comments to the editors should not, that was my do not, it's not a cut and paste, they should not echo the comments to the authors. They should be concordant with the comments, but they have to be much more direct and pithy and clarify in just a few sentences why you came to the decision that you came to. That's what we're looking for. We will read over the response, your review to the authors. We look at that for sure. But what we're looking at in these editor's comments is sort of a distillation of the essence of that, well, I'll keep going back to calling the gestalt, but this sort of general view of how this paper fits into what's out there, why it's important or not, why you came to this decision. And yes, it always should be there. You should not leave that blank. Otherwise, you know, as far as the editorial board is concerned, that's one way to not be asked back. It's very important to get, and this is true for every journal, and having done this for plenty of journals, it's very important to give that information to the editors in a very direct and a concise way.
So a couple more questions. I'm going to take, I'm going to give you two or three more at most, and then we'll move on to Dr. Kanagi. What is the best way to be critical without getting a bad reviewer rating?
You don't get a bad reviewer rating for being critical. I mean, a bad reviewer rating is going to come if, A, you provide ambiguous reviews, which don't really help direct a study one way or another, or confusing, or you, as I suggested, try to turn studies into something else completely that turn out to be very much at odds with the other reviewers. And you, for us as editors, if you're consistently out of sort of off in a different direction from everybody else that reviews papers, that's not going to be, you may be, unless you're absolutely right every time, I suppose, it takes a while for us to figure out, but that wouldn't necessarily give you a high rating. Good critiques, as opposed to simply being critical, is what we're after. I mean, good, thoughtful, really focusing on the bigger issues that will make a paper better. The critical experiment, the killer experiment that would be a good suggestion that you might imagine someone throwing out at a seminar that was just given when this was presented, and then the person standing up with the chalkboard would say, yeah, that's a great idea, we should do that. Those are the reviews that are really useful. If you provide a whole bunch of suggestions, and even if all of them were done, it wouldn't change anything really important about the paper. It wouldn't change its conclusions. It wouldn't really change. That's a lot of work. And you see those sorts of reviews, but I don't particularly view that as terribly helpful. So really good critiques that make sense, that are really going to improve the paper when addressed because they're real problems. That's what gets good ratings. That's what gets good reviews.
Okay, great. So I'm going to throw one more question your way. Do you have a way to draw the line between papers that merit rejection versus resubmission with major revision, particularly if new data are requested? Do you simply provide as much info to the editor and then let them decide?
No, I think as a reviewer, you're supposed to sort of argue your case, and those are two separate categories. So you have to sort of at least provide the editor with your opinion as to where that falls. And it can be a fine line if what you're asking for, what you see would be required, is just starting all over again or a ton of new data, then I would say then that's going to be a reject. Part of the answer to this question, though, is I sound like a broken record, but it is the gestalt. It's that initial, if this looks really important, if you can imagine that if they did this, 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 and this, this would be really great. This would be a fantastic paper. This would really be very novel and exciting. Then I would give them the chance to do it, even if it's going to take a while. If the answer to that question is it won't change anything really, even if they did all that stuff, it'd be better, but it still won't be terribly exciting, and it won't be all that novel, and it won't move things forward all that much, it'd be okay. Then no, then I would argue that's probably a better one for a reject. So when it's requiring so much revision that you're almost thinking of just saying reject, then how novel and how exciting and how innovative, creative the story is, I think helps make your decision for it. But don't leave that entirely up to the editors. We're asking you for your opinion. You're the ones who know the field more directly and better than we do. You're our partners in this.
Well, thank you very much. I think that was super informative, and we're going to move on. All right. So, Dr. Kanagi, go for it.
Okay. So I'll see if I can say some things that, David didn't say. And what I'm going to talk about are things that make a good or bad review for the authors, as opposed to what makes a good or bad review specifically to the associate editors. And so if we go to the first slide, I'm going to start with the negative and talk about a few things that really don't help the editor, don't help the authors in making their paper better. So the first is extreme brevity in your review. So even a good paper needs a statement of why it's good. So that covering the good points and the bad points are important for even the outliers, the really good papers and the really bad papers. Extreme brevity doesn't help the associate editors make a decision and doesn't help the authors improve their manuscript. So the next thing are these rude or arrogant comments. And probably any of you that have published papers for very long have occasionally seen these. And you know, the type of things that you as an author want to immediately write back and say, well, nasty words. And so those are not very helpful. Stating things in a factual manner are much more effective than moving into the emotional, derogative, rude, and really inappropriate comments in the reviews. These are anonymous, but that doesn't mean that they are not still done with professional courtesy. And so my rule of thumb is if you wouldn't say it to someone to their face, then you probably shouldn't say it in the review either. And the next thing that really isn't very helpful in a review is if the reviewer makes a scientific error or misquotes the literature. And this does happen. And so if you're going to reference one of your critiques, use the right reference. Check these references and make sure that factually you're correct when you give these scientific comments. And then my last comment for what makes a bad review, oh, I guess I have two more. First is this one. We talked about acceptance or rejection a little bit with David, but that doesn't belong in the review. You put that in your comments to the editor, and then the editor makes that decision. And so it's just not acceptable to say this paper should be accepted or rejected in the review comments to the authors. And then finally, the last piece is sloppy writing. And so I'm looking a little, trying to be entertaining here, but if you have spelling errors, if you have bad grammar, it just takes away from the points that you're making. And you can have an excellent critique, but it just gets downgraded if you don't check it before you send it off. So do a little bit of checking, spell checking, grammar checking when you send in your reviews, because these go out exactly as they are to the authors. And so these are the things that really we don't want to see in a review. And so then if we go and we look at the other side and talk about well, then what makes a good review. And so when we look at a good review, there's a couple of points that I want to make. And the first is we critique the science. And so in critiquing the science, this goes back to what David was saying, is you're looking at the major strengths and the weaknesses of the science itself, independent of the writing style. And this also gets then to a question that was asked by one of the attendees of, you know, what do you do if the language is really bad? Well, the first thing is you look at the science. And just as David was outlining things to look for, you know, you look for were the appropriate controls and approaches used? Does this address an important area? Are the observations that are there novel enough and robust enough to make a significant advance in the field? And some of you may have heard the comment of least publishable unit, of what's the minimum that it takes to make a paper novel, to make a paper robust enough that it's going to make an impact. And so those are the things that we'd like to see in the comments to the author on the science itself. And so in addition to looking at the strengths and weaknesses, then you can make specific changes. And this was that part that David was talking about, you know, the question in the seminar of what's needed to just push this to the next step. Not all studies need this. So if there aren't any more studies needed, then don't suggest that the authors do additional studies. It's not always necessary. And if you're going to do this and you want to improve the science, it's really very helpful to use references to support your suggestions. If there are minor additional studies that can be suggested, but there are studies that will mean the authors have to go back to the laboratory, this is a major revision. And so that's how you would mark it, is as a major revision. Whereas if you see multiple additional studies or major studies that will take months to complete, you can suggest them, but then the paper really is a reject because it's incomplete. So if the study is that incomplete that it really requires major studies to bring it up to the level of something novel and robust, then that would warrant a reject. And remember again, no additional studies needed is a valid option. And so these are the things that we'd like you to think about in critiquing the science and sending that to the author. In addition, you are very welcome and invited to critique the presentation as well. Sort of in a brief critique of the writing style. So you can look at the introduction, and the introduction should be convincing. It should be an appropriate review of the relevant background literature that leads you to the scientific question that's being addressed by the study. And so that's one place that you can look at it. Is the introduction convincing that this is an important study to do? And then, again, you can look at the conclusions. So you look at the data that's presented, and you look at the conclusions that are written in the discussion, and are they justified by the data? So those are writing styles more than specific science that needs to be redone. And then, again, finally, does the discussion indicate how the results impact and advance the field? And so putting it into the context of the literature, too. And so these are just specific things that are critiques of the writing style. You can make suggestions to improve the presentation. And this is where grammar style points come in. So suggestions to clarify or expand certain sections, the methods, the results, or the conclusions, to include references that were left out, you know, those would be a minor revision. If, however, the paper requires a major reorganization of the presentation, if they need to reanalyze the data, then this gives moving into the area more of a major revision, where there may be good ideas in the science, but it gets kind of lost in the presentation. And so it has to go back and really be rewritten. And ideas of how to organize it are very helpful to the authors. If you can't interpret the data because the writing is so garbled or unclear, and this is where it came back then to the comment or the question by one of our attendees, then, yes, you can look at the science, and maybe David and I come down a little bit different place on this, but if it is so garbled that it's very difficult to interpret, then I would say that's a reject. You can offer suggestions of how to rewrite it, and sometimes this can go back as a de novo submission, and so we say, okay, you can work on redoing this and then send it back to us. So these are ways then that reviewers can helpfully critique the presentation or writing style of the authors. And so in all of this, what we see then is that the reviewer is really serving as a consultant to the author. And so what I mean by that, it's that the good reviewer has the goal of improving the paper at hand and not turning it into a completely different study. So you can point out missing controls or studies that are needed to interpret the data and evaluate the clarity of the presentation. If we go to our next point, you can make appropriate suggestion for new studies, but before you suggest new studies, really think through, are they really necessary before conclusions can be made, or are these those sort of, you know, one more antagonist, one more control? If they're not necessary, they're not necessary. The suggested studies then should fit within the scope of the work that's been proposed by the authors and not lead to a major expansion of the work. And the other one, and again, this is maybe one where we can have this perhaps during our discussion period between David and I, but if the studies can't be done within this 90-day revision period, then it's probably beyond the scope of what really is a major revision. If the study is being done on an animal model that's a six-month treatment protocol, it's not realistic to ask for a whole new set of studies on that animal model because it doesn't fall within that 90-day revision window. Occasionally, there certainly are some exceptions to that, but in general, if there are major studies that are needed, then it may be beyond the scope of what's really a revision. And so then, if we look to a summary of what I would say is a good review for the authors, to summarize, you indicate the major strengths and weaknesses of the study, including novelty, but this then is really independent of the writing style. And then secondly, you include references to support your comments. You can briefly critique the writing style and suggest changes to improve the science of the study. Now here then is where I have briefly critiqued the writing style and then suggest the changes to improve the presentation. And then finally, helpful comments to the editor telling what you really think and why. And so with this then, this covers a bit of what are the notes to the editor, as well as then focusing on what are the comments to the authors. And so if you hit all of these high points, then we were talking about ratings of reviewers. These are the ones that I give the excellent rating to if they hit all of these points. And so with that, then I'm open for questions.
Great. So I'm actually going to bring back all of our panelists. So you might imagine we have a lot of great questions. And let me go to this question, which is, if I already have rejected the article for a journal and have been asked to review by AJP, Hart, and CERC, what is the policy to deal with such a situation?
Personally, when I've previously reviewed, I think this is the question, if I've reviewed a manuscript for a different journal and I recommended rejection, and now I'm getting it back again, essentially for AJP or whatever, any other journal. Usually when I'm asked by the editor, I will comment to the editor in my response before looking at it again, saying, I've done this already, and frankly, I think the author should have a different set of eyes, because I know what I'm going to say, and I don't believe, I can tell immediately that the paper is simply the same paper I just reviewed, and I could push the same button and send the same review out, which was a rejection for the last paper. Fundamentally, I don't see how it's going to change very much, and it just seems fair to the authors that they get someone else to read it. So that's my personal approach. I don't know that everyone does that, but that's what I do.
Well, I'm going to move on to a question for Dr. Carnegie. Do you think it's important to divide the review into major and minor comments? I think that's particularly important when it comes to the comments of the authors, relevant rather.
It is, and it's helpful to the authors so that they know, okay, these are the ones that they really think I should address in major comments, and then minor comments are ones that aren't going to affect the reject, revise decision as much. And so in that way, is it critical? No, it's not absolutely necessary to divide it that way, but is it helpful? Yes, would be my take on that one.
Okay, great. So it was mentioned that brevity is not recommended, but can a critique be too long? And if so, how long is too long? That's from Samantha.
I've had comments from some authors that AJP reviews are too long, but usually that's not the case. If you're getting to the point where you're doing a line-by-line critique and the reviews are editing the manuscript, that's probably too long. If the comments that you're giving are all helpful, then too long is going to be determined a little bit by the authors, but I seldom see that problem. Too long is hardly ever an issue. I don't know, Dave, do you ever see too long of reviews?
Well, I've received them. but I think, when I think about all the reviews that I've looked at from as an editor from various other folks, it's very rare that a review goes much more than, two pages. I would say, just throw out a number. I think that's about right. Usually that anything more than that, you probably have gotten into some level that it should be possible to convey to the authors what you need to say with that.
Yeah,
Otherwise, you're probably getting a bit too big.
One page is much more typical. Yeah. 2 pages is thorough, and over 2 pages is, yeah, maybe beyond what should be there.
Yeah.
Good answers. All right, I'm going to move on to this question, which is, so if a reviewer suggests new experiments and the authors respond, do those experiments and submit the new data, is the paper seen as mostly acceptable, or does it go through a full round of review on a revision?
It goes through a full round of review. And so sometimes the new studies don't really address the problems that were brought up, and so that it goes back to reviewers, and occasionally the new studies bring up new problems. I know as authors that's an awful thing to hear. I did what you asked and it's still not good enough, but I don't know, sometimes it's not. That's my take on it, at least as an editor.
Let me point out that the editors do have the option of not forwarding a revised paper back to the original reviewers. And we take that, but it's pretty rare. And I would agree, Nancy, that it's virtually never done when additional experiments were specifically requested and have now been provided, unless... I would just leave it at that. That would be very, very unusual for us not to then, in that setting, send it back to you, to reviewers. It would have to be a very minor issue, you know, just discussion points. There are some conditions where, as an editor, I can easily read the response from the authors. I feel very familiar with the field anyway, and that's the end of it. But generally, no, it goes back.
So I'm going to suggest this question is one for Bill. It's from Matthew Muller. When would you suggest that a rejected paper be sent directly to Physiological Reports? Does this mean it was, quote unquote, a near miss?
Yeah, so this is a new thing we do, and it's done also by other journals who have kind of a baby journal. So with the AJP, APS journals and Journal of Physiology and all that, they have this open access journal, Physiological Reports, that just started. And when we reject papers now, we have the option of referring them directly to Physiological Reports, where we use the same reviewers if possible, if they're willing, and then make a decision, or they make a decision whether to accept or not. So how do we decide whether to send it there? No, it's pretty much if it's it doesn't affect our decision making at all. It's only when it's been rejected. We don't say, well, normally we would take this, but now let's reject it and send it to Physiological Reports. That doesn't happen. So it's not a near miss. It's when it's a clear rejection, but the data are of good quality. The questions are good, but there's a limited novelty or new information or maybe limited importance, but it still adds something to the field, then we'll refer it to Physiological Reports. If it's just not much there and we reject it, then we won't send it to Physiological Reports. So it doesn't mean it's a near miss at all. It just means it's been rejected, and it doesn't affect our decisions at all. It's just trying to help out this new journal and keep papers in our system, the APS system.
It also suggests, though, that the paper was quality research,
yeah.
So that it was solid science, but perhaps didn't reach the level of the priority score for AJP.
Yeah, we would never send it.
It is in that way. It's.
Yeah.
I guess that's how.
It's a quality measurements and quality design. The results support the conclusions, generally, and then we'll send it there. If it's just bad science, there's no way we're going to send it to Physiological Reports. So it's, I don't know what we're doing. We're probably sending like a quarter of the reject papers there, something like that. So it's not like we're sending everything there. It has to be quality measurements, and the results have to support the conclusions. Because it has to be something that people want to know there.
Let me move on to a question about conflicting reviewer comments. So how does the editor decide on the on the paper if one reviewer suggests minor revision and another reviewer suggests the paper be rejected, or, as sometimes happens, someone suggests acceptance and another rejection. And how do the editors handle that? And is there any discussion between the reviewers and the editors about the striking difference in reviews?
Yeah, Nan, you want to answer that?
And it happens all the time. So if that happens, then I see that and I have kind of a mental groan and say, oh, okay, I'm going to have to act as a fourth reviewer. And so under those situations, I have to read the paper, I have to read all of the reviews, and I have to review the reviews to decide, you know, are they saying the same thing but coming out in a different place? And if they are doing that, then how do I weigh those critiques? Because some people have something is the death knell, and it's their particular bias on that topic, which may not be in consensus with the rest of the field, or at least with my take. And so that way, I almost become the fourth reviewer. Is there any consultation with the reviewers? I have occasionally sent notes back to reviewers, and maybe I shouldn't confess it when the senior editor's online, but I'm saying, you know, you gave this level of a review and you ranked it in the lower 50%. Do you really mean that this paper is unacceptable or what? And look for some clarity, because sometimes those comments to the editor are not very clarifying. And so I've occasionally asked for clarification on what they mean. So that's how I handle it.
Yeah, it's an important issue because often they're quite different, and we have to go back and really read. And sometimes we use reviewers who will never accept the paper but provide useful comments. And like Nan said, maybe get on the phone, call them up, and explain why we accepted the paper against their wishes. But it's our decision as editors.
Let me go quickly through about five more questions, and then I think we'll all sign off. Should your review be or critique be influenced by the impact factor of the journal?
Well, really quick, I don't. You know, impact factor doesn't really tell you that much. I think the thing about APS journals is we require quite rigorous measurements and statistics and quality data. Which I'm not so sure the really high-impact journals care so much about. They'll often let things go with very small sample size and all that, but we won't. We'll publish a lot of very late nerdy things or very specialized things that those journals won't. If we think it's important physiology but may not get referenced much, I really don't care. It's about quality and innovation, and some of the areas that we publish in, they don't get referenced much, so that affects the impact factor. But when reviewing, I think different journals have different standards, and you should keep that in mind. Yeah, but it's not really your decision about acceptance and rejection. It's up to the editor, so it doesn't really affect my review that much, what journal I'm reviewing for. It may impact how I rate it as accept or not accept, but not what I write on the page as a critique.
Let me go on to a question that's kind of goes to the nitty-gritty detail. In regards to reviewing a resubmission that you categorized as a major revision, so a revision that you've recommended as a reviewer, major revision, it comes back, and this question is, how do you rank whether the author addressed your concerns satisfactorily? Do the authors have to address every single point that you as a reviewer have made?
Nan, Dave, you want to answer that?
Well, I think as an author responding to reviewers, I've always basically literally cut and paste the review into a document and proceed to answer every single comment. Now that's actually how I approach revising a manuscript, and often responding to every single comment, sometimes before I actually even have the data, but thinking, okay, we did this. This is what we're going to do, and I can sort of plan the approach. But basically, everything gets responded to. Now, it may not be that we did the experiments. If we didn't think the experiments were were needed or appropriate, in which case, obviously, the answer is no. Not everything that, that reviewers are going to request has to be done, and if the response to the reviewers, in that case, comes back, goes back to the original reviewers, and the original reviewers read it and disagree with your, you know, the author's arguments. We didn't do it because we didn't think it was important. We didn't do it because it wouldn't matter or whatever. And they come back and say, no, absolutely, they must do it. Then as the editors, we, you know, we take that seriously. We would be looking for, at that point, some concurrence of opinion. And that's a situation like Nancy described where if out of a number of reviewers, two have now completely signed off on everything that the authors did, and one of them is still upset about something or other, you know, feels that this absolutely has to be done, they didn't do it, you know, forget it, then there are several approaches that we can take. Sometimes we actually go for a short opinion of a completely de novo person to solve this. Sometimes, personally, I will go to the folks who signed off. Instead of going to the person who still has a problem, I would go to the people without anybody knowing necessarily, go to the person, people who said it was great, it's fine, we're done, and say, well, what about this? This seems to be a bit of an issue. Do you think this is important or not? And let them go ahead and say what they think very directly. And it comes both ways. They may say, well, actually, you know, that there's a point, but we don't think it's, you know, for this reason. But fundamentally, you're trying to decide. It's certainly not a, it's not a numbers game. It's not automatic, you know, unless this gets taken care of now, it won't be published. I think that that's where the editors have leeway, and you're trying to use judgment, you know, like a judge, a court judge.
So you don't have to do every study, but you have to address every point.
Yes, everything should have some response. I think that's just good practice for authors.
And as reviewers, it's very important when you get a revised manuscript, if you think they didn't respond appropriately, to let us know and reject it. And the R1s, the first revisions, we do reject 10% of them because the authors just didn't do what they needed to do. Maybe it's more than 10%. And it's very helpful as reviewers if you can really make it clear why it should be rejected at first revision and that they didn't do it. There's a tendency for reviewers to not be all that critical on the first revisions, and that's good. That's not good. You'd be just as critical as with the first revision. Make sure they did what they were asked to do and that the paper is really improved if it needed to be improved.
So I have two key last questions. One is, what happens if, as a reviewer, you're reviewing a revision and you feel it's just not up to par? Can you suggest rejection at that point, at the first revision stage?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yes, we really appreciate it when you do that. And if you say why and do it, yeah.
That was an easy answer. I thought you guys would like that one. Okay.
Yep.
And, okay, so I think this goes to a question many people have. If a reviewer finds a major error in the methods and thus the conclusion is not reliable, is a full review required?
Yeah, that's a good question. So if it's really, really bad, usually I catch those and they don't go out for review. or the associate editor figures it out and we don't send it out. But sometimes, you know, we just don't get it. And so if you feel that way, you can just explain why it's got a fatal flaw and you don't have to write a really lengthy review, but you really need to tell us what's wrong with it politely to the authors as well in your critique, and that should suffice.
And this is where references are very helpful. If you can outline what the fatal flaw is, base that on, you know, referenced comments, then, and say it in a polite manner, then that's a very appropriate review.
Great. Well, I'd like to thank our panelists especially, and also thank all of our attendees this afternoon, evening, various times around the world. Bill's joining us from Sydney, Australia, and we have New Mexico and Baltimore. So thanks, everyone. And as a reminder, we will send all of our attendees a link to this, a recording of this webinar, along with a link to the slides after the fact, and we'll also post it on the AJP Heart and Circulatory website. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks.